Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of CR Writers. Today, it's my pleasure to have as a guest one of the stars of the show. I know she probably doesn't want me to introduce her that way, but she truly is one of the stars of the show. And that is Dr. Lee Hedder. And she is a scientist at Women's College Research Institute, the staff rheumatologist and co-director of the cardiorheumatology program at Women's College Hospital, as well as an associate professor of medicine, research director, division of rheumatology at the University of Toronto. And if those credentials were not enough, I want to also share with you that I guess less than 2 years ago, Dr. Hedder, you were awarded a Canada Research Chair, which is allowing you to continue your focus on research in rheumatology with a health equity lens, as rheumatology disproportionately affects, as we know, older individuals and people living in underserved communities. Dr. Hedder, welcome to our show.
Thank you so much for having me, and thank you to you for the very kind introduction.
Now, you're going to be very busy in Winnipeg at the conference. You're not only a keynote presenter with a presentation on titled From Psoriasis to Psoriatic Arthritis Towards Prevention. You also are leading two workshops, one on can we predict who will develop a rheumatic disease beyond rheumatoid arthritis, and a second workshop, Beyond Sight, Unveiling Psoriatic Arthritis Through Imaging. I thought today we could go through some, I think, fairly fundamental questions, which is going to allow you, I think, to weave in some of the learnings and findings that you're going to share at the meetings in Winnipeg. And I guess the first question for our audience is, what are the key risk factors, if you will, for the progression from psoriasis to psoriatic arthritis, or PSA?
So I'll just start by saying that most of the data that I'll be presenting in Winnipeg is coming from a cohort study that we've established in Toronto about 15 years ago, where we follow patients with psoriasis over time. We evaluate them every year and we examine whether they develop psoriatic arthritis. And then we can go back and study what are the risk factors. And I'll be sharing the knowledge that we have accumulated and learned over the past 15 years. So first, I think it's important to know that about 3%, so 3 out of 100 people living with psoriasis will convert to psoriatic arthritis every year. So I know it doesn't sound like a lot, but I mean, over the course of life, this can accumulate to up to a 30% of the people with psoriasis developing psoriatic arthritis. And part of the reasons why we're doing this research is that if we identify risk factors, we can sort of hopefully identify this group of people that are at highest risk and perhaps down the road intervene and prevent progression or and delay the progression. So we've learned a few things. I mean, in terms of risk factors, there are what we call environmental risk factors. There are genetic risk factors. And then there is the effect of treatment that I know we'll be talking about it later on. In terms of genetics, there are some specific genes, but the effect of each particular gene is not very high. And therefore, there is at this point in time, there is no blood test or genetic test that we recommend of doing to predict who will develop the disease. But just asking if someone has a family history of psoriatic arthritis, a first degree relative, then that increases the risk by about 30 times. So it's certainly an important risk factor. Then there are what we call environmental risk factors, and these could be things like trauma. So injury to the joint can trigger inflammation that can turn into psoriatic arthritis. And this is sometimes called Kebner phenomenon, And Koebner phenomenon is a phenomenon that was described in the skin, where there is injury to the skin triggers psoriasis. So we think that the same process might be happening in the joints. And then this is important for people, but also physicians, to know that if someone develops an injury or had an injury to the joint and there is inflammation that continues and goes on, that may be the first sign of psoriatic arthritis. Then there are some features that are associated with skin disease, so with the psoriasis itself, that can identify those that are at high risk of progression. So two key things are severe psoriasis, so someone that has a lot of body surface area affected by the psoriasis itself, and someone that has nail lesions, so the pitting or the separation of the nail from the nail bed. These have been shown by us and also by other groups outside of Toronto to be important risk factors for psoriatic arthritis. And then finally, and this is something that we've also reported based on this cohort, the presence of non-specific musculoskeletal symptoms. So we learned that many people start developing some joint pain and morning stiffness and fatigue several years before there is actually objective findings on physical exam. So people will start noticing these symptoms, but then when they go to see the rheumatologist and the rheumatologist is examining their joints, we don't pick up anything at this point. And we may say, oh, this is age related, this is fibromyalgia, this is something else. But in this cohort, we learned that these people are at very high risk of progression down the road. So we need to be careful before we discharge people with psoriasis that have symptoms. And we need to examine carefully and sometimes use imaging to identify inflammation that is still very early to present itself as swelling in joints, for example. So, I mean, these are a few things. And more recently, we've put all of this together and created a tool that is called Presto. And this is a prediction score that allows us to estimate the risk of progression to psoriatic arthritis for someone who has psoriasis based on these risk factors that I mentioned. So we can estimate what is the actual risk.
So in the literature, and certainly we've talked to our audience at Arthritis Consumer Experts quite a bit about the importance of early detection and intervention with inflammatory arthritis, and psoriasis patients are no different. Why is early detection and intervention so important for psoriasis patients potentially to prevent this onset of PSA?
So this is a concept that has been studied a lot in rheumatoid, less so in psoriatic, but still some studies show that it is easier, or the disease is more responsive in earlier stages. So, you know, people tend to respond and maintain the response over time if we start treatment early compared to if we wait. Also, there is the issue of damage. So once there is damage, we know the damage is irreversible. So people that it takes time to make the diagnosis or to start treatment, these people tend to develop damage earlier on, I mean, until they actually start treatment, and then this becomes irreversible and leads to disability and other problems in down the road.
Now, we know that in your clinical work and research, there is the use of these sort of musculoskeletal ultrasound machines that are really large and expensive. But imaging techniques are becoming more sophisticated and very important. And I also know this is an area with your research chair when it comes to access to care, that for a lot of people living with psoriasis or psoriatic arthritis are having to travel a long way and find it very difficult sometimes to get access to these kind of of healthcare interventions. Maybe if you put on that research chair hat, can you just talk to us a little bit about these challenges in access to care for these patients?
Yeah, I mean, this is a very important point because especially I think for psoriatic arthritis, but also for other rheumatic diseases, we know that ultrasound is better than our physical exam. And I know every rheumatologist thinks they are best on physical exam, but there are limitations. And especially with early disease, our ability to capture inflammation accurately is still limited when we only use our hands. So ultrasound can certainly identify inflammation, especially in these earlier phases where it's quite hard. So ultrasound has been part of rheumatology practice, more so in Europe, less so in Canada. And one of the barriers is the cost of the equipment, and these machines are quite expensive. It also takes training and practicing with it. And many rheumatologists, when they go to the community, there are concerns about, you know, cost of paying for such a machine. So these machines typically exist in large academic centers where, as we know, serve mostly people in large cities, and people that live far away have less access to these equipments that could potentially improve care, help with diagnosis, help guide procedures, and so on. So with advanced technologies, there are now handheld devices. So these are about the size of a cell phone, and they connect
Wow.
to a laptop or to an iPad. And the cost is quite significantly lower, I would say at least 10 times lower than these big machines. Now, the main concern still is that in order to pick up inflammation in the joints, we need certain technical parameters for a machine to have. Especially, we are interested in Doppler signal, which is blood flow within the joint. So the machine needs to be sensitive enough to be able to pick up this slow flow in the joint. So there's been a few models and few, I mean, brands that exist, and we are now working on trying to validate one of these handheld devices that is actually manufactured in Vancouver. So it's a Canadian product, and we test it against this gold standard of a big machine. This is a study that is actually led by a Dr. Sibel Aydin from Ottawa. So we are trying to see whether we can pick up the same amount of inflammation that we pick up with the gold standard, the best machine, with these handheld devices. And the next step will, if we actually validate, I can say that the initial signs are very positive, that down the road, we do hope to see how we can use these not so expensive devices in actual care of patients. And the main idea will be to, I mean, use it outside of these academic centers where there is the expertise, and then in the hands of either community rheumatologists or even ACPAC trained care providers. These are a few ideas that we have. I think validation is really key initially to make sure that we are providing care that is sufficient or at least as good as the gold standard.
Well, it's fantastic. I mean, we're talking about life-changing technology, again, for those people who don't live close to an academic center and, you know, think about how many people that is living outside of that southern kind of urban parallel in Canada. That's really, really exciting news. And we certainly will be following your work and research in this area and look forward to talking to you about that in the future. If we go back to the theme of how do we prevent the progression from psoriasis to PSA, can you briefly talk to us about The research that has looked at the role of behavior or lifestyle changes, modifications, and how also possibly patient education can be key elements to preventing that progression.
So, I mean, in terms of lifestyle, I didn't mention one of the most important risk factors for progression, which is obesity. And we know that higher BMI is associated with higher risk of developing both psoriasis and psoriatic arthritis. We are very interested in this topic, and we are actually doing a diet study now looking at the effect of Mediterranean diet versus other types of diets and see whether this could improve disease activity in psoriatic arthritis. But I mean, if we do see some positive signal, that could also maybe down the road be a potential lifestyle change that could be helping or reduce the risk of progression. There is a lot of interest, obviously, in the new medication of weight reduction that is are now available, and there is still no study, but that's obviously something that at some point we'll need to investigate, because some reports, mostly looking at surgical intervention for weight reduction, showed reduction of the risk of progression to PSA. So it's something about the weight that might influence. And when people are asking me, people with psoriasis are asking me what they can do to prevent progression, I say maintaining healthy weight is good in general, but may also reduce the risk. So that's something to keep in mind. And then in terms of patient educations, I think it's still a gap that we have, that many people with psoriasis are unaware of this potential risk to progress. And here is where we should be doing a better job of educating people living with psoriasis, mostly because people will typically develop the skin disease first and then progress to having arthritis. So perhaps, I mean, I know that there are some patient organizations, especially organizations of psoriasis, like National Psoriasis Foundations and other Canadian organizations, that are doing really good job, but still, there are still gaps.
You touched on treatments earlier, and maybe we can spend a little time there. Are there any specific treatments for psoriasis that have been shown to reduce the risk of developing PSA?
So that this is a very another very important question, and that is hard to study. There are lots of biologic medications now, actually, with psoriasis. They are very, very effective biologic therapies that can completely clear the skin disease. And the question is, obviously, we can't put everyone on biologic, and especially this, the decision whether to start treatment depends mostly on the severity of the skin. So, I mean, it's probably mostly relevant to people with moderate to severe psoriasis to consider whether they want to be on a biologic medication or go and do phototherapy, for example. So I can say that there has been a few observational studies, meaning using databases and then trying to see whether people who are on biology compared to people who are on phototherapy or people that were using just creams. And these studies showed really conflicting results. So there are lots of biases when you do that, because this is not a randomized trial, and there are different reasons why some people prefer to be on biologic and some people prefer not to be on biologic, and that can influence the risk. So I'm not going to go into that, but there was one particular study that it was published last year and compared different classes of biologics. So all of these were people with psoriasis that were prescribed the biologic therapy to treat their skin disease. And they showed that people who were on certain classes of biologic, specifically IL-23 inhibitors, had lower chances of progressing compared to people who were on TNF inhibitors. So, I mean, this is some clue that maybe some classes of biological medications are better than others in terms of prevention of progression, but this is still observational data. We are also now working with colleagues from NYU on a prevention trial in psoriasis patients. So in this trial, people are randomized to get a biologic therapy versus placebo, and we do an ultrasound at the beginning and after 6 months. And the idea is to try and understand whether treatment with this particular biologic therapy could improve ultrasound parameters and also maybe reduce the risk of progression. So this is really the first trial that is actually designed to answer, hopefully, this question.
If we quickly move back to the work you're doing under your research chair, I know one of the areas that we've talked about with you is the phenomenon of the sex and gender disparities associated with PSA. And what made me think of this, and maybe you could elaborate a little bit, is that you're looking again at people's response and comparing people's response to medication and treatments. In this case, women who generally, I think, tend to respond less well to medication treatments who are living with PSA. Maybe you can just touch a little bit on the work that you're doing with the research chair in that area.
So yeah, I'm specifically about treatment, you're right. Women tend to do worse. And we were interested in trying to study data from randomized controlled trial. This is a study that we've just published in Lancet Rheumatology. It's a meta-analysis that we explored data from RCTs on biologic therapies in psoriatic arthritis. And as we expected in all of the monoclonal antibodies, like all of these classes of TNF inhibitors, IL-17, IL-23 inhibitors, there was this gap where female patients were less likely to achieve response. But to our very surprise, we were very surprised to see that among a specific class of advanced therapies, JAK inhibitors and TYK2 inhibitors, we didn't see any difference. So the response was similar in male and female. And this triggered this question of, okay, why is that happening? Is it something that has to do with the pharmacokinetics of drugs? Is it something that has to do with the immune system between male and female patients that is different, and therefore some medications might work for males but not for females? So it triggered a lot of questions, but I think it was really exciting to see that maybe in the future we will consider sex of patient when we come and select medications. So, I mean, it's a very exciting idea. We don't have a lot of insights because this is a meta-analysis, but I can say that we lead a study now within GRAPPA, which is an international organization that will study some of these potential mechanisms that underlie this differential response in male and females. And we plan on recruiting over 500 patients from more than 20 countries, and we will try to explore these differences. I mentioned immune mechanisms, and there is weight, and there is also the gender issue. Of course, it's a whole topic of you know, gender roles, and women typically take on a lot of responsibilities, and that could influence the way they cope with arthritis. And you know, there are lots of different reasons. But in typical studies, people don't think about it and don't collect information that allow us to try and tease out these sociocultural aspect of being a man or a woman from the biological aspects of, you know, sex hormones and immune response and all of these other things. So this study is called SAGE-PSA, and we are recruiting, and we hope that in about 2 years we'll have some some insights, and you can interview me then, and I'll be able to share the new knowledge.
You're on. when we get off this interview, I'll try and schedule something for us in 2 years. So I look forward to that. I want to thank you again, Dr. Nader, for joining us today. I think what's really exciting about CR Arthritis, the CR Arthritis program that we host every year at the annual meeting, is we get to talk to Canadian leaders. And I'm so excited for our audience, because with you, we're actually talking to a world leader and somebody who's in Canada doing breaking and breakthrough research. So it's really exciting for us to be able to share time with you as you continue to identify gaps in research and address these gaps regarding the prevention of PSA in individuals with psoriasis, such a important topic for so many people. And we're really proud that you're with us today and that you're conducting this research in Canada. So congratulations again. So thank you again for your time.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Of course. And thanks to our audience for joining us for another episode from CR Arthritis. Thanks again. Bye-bye.